7. They labored in the mine 24 hours a day with 3 shifts. Inward further and further they drove along the barren white quartz vein. And then on day 60 the vein faltered. Some ancient cataclysm had shifted it up or down, to the right or left. Suddenly there was just country rock before them. No more vein. The possibility that they would lose it had not been missing from their calculations. For weeks now, they had been sending out scouts to locate any stored gold within their range of recovery. They had been given hope by Johnny's earliest discovery of a gold coin in a bank vault in Denver. But most of the coins left were just curiosities, worthless souvenirs. They were silver-plated copper. Only 5 more gold coins were in that vault, and these few ounces were a long way from making up a ton of gold. A few bits from what must have been jewelry shops added another pitiful 2 ounces. Mining company officials at old mines through the mountains had no gold in their vaults, though they found plenty of receipts. The receipts all said, "Shipped so many ounces to the U.S. Mint, Denver," or "Shipped such and such poundage of concentrate to the smelter." In a perilous journey in a plane, carrying heavy supplies of fuel in reserve, Donald Dean, a co-pilot and a gunner, flying by night to escape drone detection, went all the way to the eastern coast to a place once called New York. They found the buildings mostly knocked down, but some gold vaults, tunneled into and empty. They also visited a place the historian had found called Fort Knox, but it was just a gutted ruin. Donald Dean had accumulated a remarkable fund of information and picto-recorder shots. Bridges gone, tumbled rubble, wild game, wild cattle, and varmints abundant, no trace of people, and they had had some hair-raising experiences. But they got no gold. They had come to the conclusion that the cyclos, as much as 1,000 years ago, had thoroughly gutted this planet of gold. They must have even taken it from corpses in the streets, rings from fingers and fillings from teeth. Possibly this, along with the cyclosport of hunting humans on days off, accounted for the thoroughness of population wipeout. There was evidence that in the early days of conquest, they had even massacred people just for their rings and fillings. They began to understand Turl a little better in his dangerous enterprise to possess the yellow metal for himself. To the humans, the metal meant very little. They had no experience of using it in trade. It was pretty and didn't tarnish, and was easily pounded into shape, but stainless steel had a lot more utility. Their own ideas of trade and thrift had to do with useful items that were real wealth. None of this got them any closer to getting a ton of gold. They frantically test-drilled for the lost vein. On day 70, they found the vein again. It had been shifted by some past upheaval 231 feet to the north, and only 30 feet from the surface. They wiped off their sweating faces, the droplets tending to freeze in the bitter winter winds of these altitudes, made a new level area for equipment and a new shaft, and began to drift again along the white quartz. The vein had thinned down to about 3 feet in width. They drove on, filling the dark air of the drift with white chips and blast fumes. Johnny went back to studying the battle reports. They must know cyclotactics very precisely. He was once again struck with the oddity of this attack on a tank in Denver, where no tank existed. He narrowed down the location on the faded satellite photos. They had kept coming off the machine even after the president was dead. Yes, there was smoke at that place. They had scouted out Denver thoroughly. Typically, Turl had not intended to work in the U.S. Mint to refine his gold. He had set up a place in the basement of the remains of a smelter a few minutes' drive away. He was just using the U.S. Mint as a receipt point. But all the gold invoices they found in the mines said U.S. Mint, and it seemed to Johnny that where so much gold was funneled in, there might be further traces there in case they missed at the load. Also, this tank that didn't exist to the U.S. military might have been guarding the mint. In a swift foray, he and Dunaldine swooped down to the U.S. Mint. They had made very sure there were no ground cars or planes as the afternoon faded. They landed in a park in the cover of giant trees and sped on silent feet to the Mint. The place was still. It had been scouted before, but once more they went over it just in case the cyclos had missed a vault. Inside they found nothing. They lingered outside in the darkness. Dunaldine amused himself by prying into the mounds that had once been cars, wondering what they looked like in the days when they could run. Johnny was thinking about the views Turl had shown him. He went around to the back and played a mine lamp on the ground so it would reflect a dim light up. Shortly, he was looking at the largest mound. It came to him that this must be the tank the battle plane had destroyed, the non-existent tank. He lifted some turf. Brown sand and grass had overlaid it. He cut the turf very carefully so it could be laid back and leave no sign of disturbance. This thing wasn't an ordinary car. It was so thickly built that it had endured the rust of time. The metal was twisted where it had burned out. He had never seen anything like this. It had a slot one might fire out of, but that would be its closest resemblance to a tank. The window frames had bars over them, a bit like a cage. What was this thing? He pried a section of metal aside with a mine crowbar and got inside. The interior had been blackened by fire, and floor plates had warped. He pried up a floor plate. Half a minute later, a smiling Johnny was making a bird call and beckoning for Dunaldine. He took the Scott inside. As one might piece together, when the cyclo attack came, the U.S. Mint had sought to evacuate its vaults. Gold. How much? In extremely heavy ingots, there it had lain neatly for 1,000 years. Overlooked, for everyone thought it was a tank. They estimated its weight with excited heftings, and then their excitement dimmed. "That's less than a tenth of a ton," said Dunaldine. "Would Turl be satisfied with that?" Johnny didn't think so. In fact, he knew Turl wouldn't. It was also far less than suited their own project.
"A tenth of a loaf is better than none," said Dunaldine.
They packed the 200 pounds of gold in the plane and put the tank back together and scattered snow on it and around it to cover tracks. They now had about 300 pounds in gold. They needed a ton. It was enough to make one take up alchemy, the mythical conversion of lead to gold, said the historian when they returned. And in fact, he spent hours that night fruitlessly studying just that. The parson made a visit to Johnny's village to prepare the people for the possibility of withdrawal into the old base. He told Johnny his Aunt Ellen sent her love, and for him to be very careful in the wild places he went. Johnny detected the parson was sweet on Aunt Ellen, and privately wished him luck. They felt bad they couldn't warn other peoples on this planet. If they failed, man might indeed become extinct. 8. The shift that went on duty at the end of day 86 began like any other shift. The vein had been narrowing lately, pinching out. They tried not to be hopeful, but shift ends, when they had not found the pocket yet, were always a bitter disappointment. Dunaldine, recovered from the cave-in, was operating a chattering spade bit, sweat streaming off him in the closed, hot confines of the drift. He had a sudden illusion that a drop of sweat had turned color as it dropped into his eye. He switched off the spade bit to clear his vision. He looked again in front of him through the swirling smoke and white dust. The illusion was still there. But it wasn't an illusion. A single round spot of yellowing gold marked the shining white vein. He put the spade bit against it and turned it on. The chattering edge bit further. He shut it off and walked closer to the vein. He stood stock still, and then let out a blasting whistle to stop the shift. He pointed, and then bedlam broke loose. It was gold. They had finally hit the second pocket. The shift abruptly left off shouting, and every bit and drill they had down there began to cut into the vein. The wire gold began to blossom against the white. An excited call went to the duty watch in town, and in a handful of minutes, they had the third shift helping them. The town went wild. Every Scot and even two of the old widows helped form a human bucket line out of the mine, weighing, sacking, and loading bag after bag of mixed wire gold and quartz. To the devil with the odd bits of rock. The gold was like twisted springs and small cages of gleaming yellow. Before sunset on day 88, they had the whole pocket out. 1,647 pounds it weighed out, subtracting the rock. Adding to that the 306 pounds they already had, it made 1,953 pounds. It was short of a ton, but it would have to do. The project was on its way. They began to oil their assault rifles. The parson prayed long and earnestly for their success. There were no parallels for odds such as these. 9. Turl waited, trying to be casual, in front of the U.S. Mint. It was 2 hours after sunset on day 89. It was good and dark. There would be no moon these next 3 nights. The weather on this cursed planet was on the edge of spring. There had already been a warm day or two. All the snow was gone. It was reasonably warm tonight, and he had been prepared to wait. Animals were pretty stupid about time. He was leaning against a flatbed truck he had driven in from the base. It was a shabby relic, not even on the inventory. It wouldn't be missed. He had prepared it carefully. But right on time, there were the animals. With only a pinpoint of light pointed at the ground, their vehicle rolled up and stopped a few feet from Turl. It was heavily laden. So they had kept their part of the bargain after all. Yes, animals certainly were stupid. There were 3 man-things in the cab, but Turl couldn't restrain his eagerness. He walked over to the flatbed and began to poke talons and a light into the sacks. Wire gold. Unrefined. Unmelted. A bit of the white quartz clinging. No, here were some melted chunks. He remembered himself and stood back and played a radiation detector on the sacks. Clean. He estimated the load by a practiced glance at the pistons that supported the body over the driving mechanism. Allowing for the slight weight of the man-things, maybe 400 pounds, and for the debris, he must have about 1,900 pounds here. Recent trade papers told him that gold, in its scarcity at home, had soared to 8,321 galactic credits an ounce. This load was worth about... he was very good at figures in his head. About 189,718,800 credits. Several dozen fortunes. Wealth and power. He felt very expansive. The animals hadn't gotten out of the cab. Turl went to the side of it and flashed a subdued light into it. These fellows all had black beards. Actually, it was Dunnell Dean, Dwight, and another Scot. Turl went through a pantomime seeking to ask where the animal Johnny was. The pantomime might or might not have been comprehensible, but Dwight, who spoke Cyclo, knew exactly what was meant. Purposely speaking in broken Cyclo, Dwight said, "Johnny not can come. Him have accident. Him hurt foot. He say we come. Much apology." Turl was a bit taken aback by the information. It upset his planning. But yes, in the recon drone pictures this afternoon, he had noticed an overturned blade scraper at the site and had seen no sign of the blonde-bearded Johnny who for months had always been visible. Well, no matter. It didn't upset much. It just delayed getting rid of the females. A hurt foot wouldn't stop that animal's psychic powers if he touched the females ahead of time. And if aroused, they could cause mischief. No mischief that he, Turl, couldn't handle.
"We help transfer sacks to other truck," said Dwight.
Turl had never intended that. "No," he said, making wide, explicit motions, rather hard to see in the dark. "We just swap trucks. You get it? I keep your truck, you take this truck." The three Scots piled out of the huge cab of the cyclo truck they had brought and got into Turl's. Dunnell Dean took the controls. He started the motors and made a wide sweep in the street, turning back the way they had come. Turl stood with a waiting smile upon his mouth bones. The truck went up to the corner and turned into a side street, out of sight of Turl. Dunnell Dean hastily punched in the numbers to keep it going down the slope. He looked sideways to make sure Dwight and the other Scot had the door open.
"Go!"
he barked. The other two dove out the door. Dunnell Dean shot his own door open and in a rolled ball hit the soft turf of the street. He glanced back. The other two were up and running for cover, a pair of darker blurs in the dark. He yanked a heat detector shield out of his belt and began to run to an alley. He made it. The flatbed went on down the street for another 100 yards. It exploded with a battering, violent concussion that blew in the buildings on both sides of the street. Back at the gold-laden flatbed, Turl chuckled. He could hear the patter of pieces beginning to hit as they returned to earth for blocks around. There was a roaring sigh as some buildings collapsed. He was pleased. He would have been more pleased if the animal had been in it. He didn't have to go and look. He wouldn't have found anything anyway. The distance fuse demolition charge had been placed under the cab seat. Turl got in the laden truck and drove to the smelter he had rigged. He had done number 5 of 7 alternate possible actions in booby-trapping and sending the truck back. It had been dicey, pre-calculating the options. The teams in anti-heat capes drew back from the surrounding buildings. They collected Dunnell Dean and the other two and went off for stage 2. Would they be this fortunate next time? Dicey indeed outguessing a mad cyclone.